may we bring you cheer.
We've got time, we've got tunes, we've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go, it's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Hi, this is Charlie Friedman. Today we'll be talking about the courts. Our first hour we'll have as a guest Burt Brandenburg, Executive Director of Justice at Stake. And we'll see if we can get some feedback from some of you out in the radio audience. If you want to call in, I'll give you the number now. It's 479-1080. Get those dialing fingers ready.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
Do you think that judicial independence is an important issue? Special interests are spending millions to influence decisions and elect judges to serve their narrow interests. Join us this Saturday on the Saturday Special from 10 a.m. to noon with special guest host Charlie Friedman and guests from the Justice at Stake campaign and noted local attorney Timothy Cleary. That's this Saturday on the Saturday Special from 10 a.m. to noon on your delicious, nutritious, and judicious radio station, AM 1080 KSU.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I'll apologize in advance to hear you. Pretty good.
And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Friedman. This is the Saturday Special on KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. And today we've got, for the first hour, Burt Brandenburg, Executive Director of Justice at Stake on our newsline. Burt, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Outstanding. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. We'll do a little bit of kind of intro here. First of all, my thrust on the program here, we were talking just a whisker before we went on the air, but we didn't really have enough time, so we'll do it to the benefit of our audience as well. I have been of the opinion for a number of years that some of our courts have just literally gone too far. They've taken the law way beyond where any kind of reasonable interpretation should go and assumed the role of legislators rather than adjudicators. Now, you come from an organization called Justice at Stake, and I'm sure the audience would be interested in hearing about your organization and its thrust.
Sure. We are a national partnership of more than 40 organizations nationwide. Our partners include, for example, the American Bar Association, state court groups like the National Center for State Courts, groups like the League of Women Voters, a lot of state groups. And what we all have in common is that what we have grown concerned about a growing common culture of attacks on the courts, and I refer specifically to political and special interest attacks, basically attempts by special interests to try to work the courts to rule in their interest rather than the public interest.
Well, I can understand where that's coming from. The history of that go back a long way. People with an axe to grind generally wind up before justices in one way or another, and they have a right to argue in their own behalf.
As long as there have been courts, there have been controversies, and there always will be. And in fact, some of the comments you were making, just an introduction, I think some of those concerns have been around for as long as we've had courts as well.
To inform our audience what Burt was referring to, just before we went on the air, I mentioned that in my opinion, and bear in mind this is just one man's opinion, although some others seem to share it, some of our courts seem to have just gone too far over the past few years, assuming the role of legislators rather than the role of interpreters of the law. We all remember from our eighth grade civics that there are three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, that the job of the legislature is to make the laws, the executive carries them out, and the judiciary interprets those laws. I'm glad, very glad, Burt, to have you on the line, because I'm sure that you're actually better informed on this than I am by leagues. There's something I wanted to ask you about to begin with. This, in my opinion, this is one of the most egregious examples. Perhaps you can give us some details on this. A few years ago, I believe it was in Kansas City, a judge, it might have been a federal judge, I'm not sure, but there was a suit brought concerning the local school system. And this judge from the bench actually ordered an increase in taxes because, in his opinion, it was warranted. Now, obviously, the power of the purse is left to our legislative branches, both on the state and local level. Are you familiar at all with this case, and what do you think of it?
Well, I'm afraid I may not be familiar with that specific case. I can think of cases that are similar to that, and I can explain what I know about them and maybe try to draw out the debate a little bit here.
Please do.
Let me go back, for example, to Brown versus Board of Education in the mid-50s, which, of course, ordered school desegregation. And
That was the decision that reversed Plessy-Ferguson from, 1896 or something, and ruled that separate in educational facilities is inherently unequal.
That's right. And, in fact, a lot of what happened afterwards, I think, leads to the case that you were describing, because it essentially took about two decades of litigation in the courts to get even modest implementation in a number of jurisdictions that wanted to resist. And one of the issues that did come up over and over was the issue of saying, okay, well, we're not going to formally segregate these schools, but we're going to give certain schools certain amounts of money and certain schools other amounts of money. And it was becoming essentially not officially separate but equal, but unequal, but it was unequal. And again, I can't necessarily speculate as to whether the case you're describing is one of those cases, but I know that there were a series of cases where funding issues became essentially racial equality issues, and there were concerns.
I could understand where there might be a concern with the way the pie is cut up, and that if an egregious abuse is taking place, and I don't deny that there have been such, then I can see a legitimate role for a court to intervene. On the other hand, to actually come in and say, well, you're not taxing people enough, and to mandate a tax increase, I would hold that that really steps over the line of what a judge or a member of the judiciary can do.
Well, like I said, with the specific case, my legal training will have to prevent me from getting into too much, since I'm not too familiar with the individual case.
That's fair enough.
Yeah,
would you be willing to make a general statement on that, though? Do you see the power of the purse as essentially a legislative function?
Well, certainly at the federal level, the Constitution describes it as such. So I actually would raise my eyebrow at the ruling you're describing, but, you know, would want to read about the case. I would say that you were talking about issues of, you know, the roles of the branches. Of course, the Congress passes laws, and there are often concerns that when a law is struck down, that somehow the court is, quote-unquote, legislating from the bench. And the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, over its history, has that on occasion struck down laws, often received these complaints. What's interesting is that actually the pace with which that is happening has actually picked up under a more conservative court. And I'm not sure this is necessarily a liberal or more conservative issue. I would say that politically lately, it's more often conservatives who complain that the courts are out of control. And yet actually under Chief Justice Rehnquist and the court that's been in place for about a decade or so, the rate with which federal laws have been struck down has increased quite a bit, from about maybe six per decade to, roughly 20 or 30 per decade by the Supreme Court. Now, you literally now have complaints about what's called conservative judicial activism. Often the phrase judicial activism is used to describe a series of complaints that courts are out of control, that they're too liberal, that they're striking down laws that the people want. And here, on the other hand, you have courts, a conservative court, striking down laws more frequently. You actually now have liberal critics standing up and saying that's conservative judicial activism. And I guess what I would suggest is that I'm not sure that the term means that much anymore, that it really is a case-by-case analysis. Sometimes legislators do go past the bounds of what's in the Constitution.
I'm sympathetic to what you've just said. I understand the argument you pose here, that at this point conservatives would be looking for, say, the overturning of certain precedents and so on. And, of course, the reason why would be that for a considerable length of time the court was dominated from the left, and a number of conservatives, I would count myself among them, are quite upset at some of the rulings. Want to do two things before we go any farther. Number one, I want to make it clear to all of our listeners, this is a call-in and audience participation radio station. We are interactive radio here at KSCO Santa Cruz. The telephone number for this program is 479-1080. We're talking about legal issues today, the roles of courts in our society, something that I'm sure touches all of our lives and certainly some of our tempers from time to time. If you would like to call in, make a point, take issue with either Bert or myself, you're more than welcome. 479-1080 is our call-in number. You can also dial 477-1340. And if you have some printed matter you'd like to bring to our attention, you may fax us at 475-2967. Just now, I'm Charles Friedman, local, what do you want to call it? Gadabout, man about town.
educator.
Debonair, bon vivant. Well, actually, I do teach school, so that's actually fair enough. And my guest is Bert Brandenburg, head of Justice at Stake, executive director of that organization, which concerns itself with attacks and observations on the role of the courts in American society. So you've got somebody here, Mr. Brandenburg, who makes this his business, is exceptionally well-informed. Take advantage of that and give us a call, 479-1080. I was thinking, sir, that we might, with your permission, talk about a couple of Supreme Court rulings that would, I'm sure, be familiar to most people. Have you read a book by Scott Armstrong and Bob Woodward called The Brethren?
You know, I'm ashamed to admit that I have it, and I've not yet read it.
Okay, this is not a new book.
No, it's not.
It came out about 1976 or 77, and Bob Woodward, of course, is of Woodward and Bernstein, the two reporters on the Washington Post who uncovered the Watergate scandal. Scott Armstrong has collaborated with Bob Woodward on a number of his books. The reason I'm pointing this out, obviously this book is not written from a right-wing political viewpoint. Now, I mentioned earlier the book Mark Levin's Men in Black, which is a brand new book. It is written from a conservative political viewpoint. So you get a different spread of things. But it had struck me. I remembered reading about, for example, the Roe v. Wade decision. It has always been, in my mind, an egregious example of court legislation. I quote Woodward and Bernstein. This is incredible. I hadn't read the book for years, but I had this impression. Here is what Bob Woodward writes on page 233. The clerks in most chambers were surprised to see the justices, particularly Blackmun, so openly brokering their decision, like a group of legislators. There was a certain reasonableness to the draft, some of them thought, but it derived more from medical and social policy than from constitutional law. It left the court claiming the Constitution drew certain lines at trimesters and viability. Now, I guess I'm one of the strangest people in the world. I'm pro-choice on abortion myself, but I believe Roe v. Wade is terrible law and should be struck down because it's an egregious example of judiciary overreach. What do you think, Mr. Brandenburg?
I would say a couple of things. One of the things you said is very interesting to me was, as you put it, Mr. Woodward said, the clerks in most chambers were, you know, it was interesting how openly they were brokering, you know, opinions. And it is interesting. And that's actually what has happened for as long as we've had courts with numbers of people who are trying to come together to a decision. And you read a biography of Justice John Marshall, our first Chief Justice, mm-hmm. and you find that this has actually been the case from the beginning. And often they do act like legislators. And some people have suggested even that people on the courts who have been legislators are sometimes the most effective because they're used to this type of work. Now, that's separate from what the product is that comes out of the court, and that's really the second part of your question. And without getting into, you know, a good hour of discussion on Roe v. Wade, on which I'm not a true expert, I know, you know, a reasonable amount, I guess I would just suggest, number one, that the people who wrote the majority opinion in good faith felt that they were operating within the Constitution, even though I know there's been a lot of, frankly, respectable disagreement. I think it's a very close call myself in terms of the jurisprudence. But I would also suggest that every controversial decision has received this attack. And so, for example, even Brown v. Board, and I would not put in your comments about Roe v. Wade into the same boat with opponents of Brown v. Board, but I would say that the exact same comments about legislating from the bench, about judicial activism, about more policy than law, were made after Brown v. Board of Education. And so what you often have after controversial decisions is the side that lost says this is outrageous. This happened as well after Bush v. Gore in 2000. You said, you know, you had people on the left saying this is incredible what they've done. They've overturned the state laws, even though this is a court that says that they respect state laws and state procedures. And I'm not one of the people who bought into the idea that it was an illegitimate decision, because it was clear to me that the five justices, even though it was a very close call legally, that the five justices felt that they had, you know, rational reasons for coming to the decision that they did.
Bert, we're going to take a momentary break here, give our listeners an opportunity to call in. This is the Saturday special on KSCO. Today I'm joined by Bert Brandenburg of Justice at Stake. Our telephone number is 479-1080, and our program will return in a couple of minutes. Thanks for being with us.
Until joint pain makes everyday activities unbearable. But you don't have to live with joint pain. Here's pharmacist Ben Fuchs to explain why.
Foods that cause the blood pH to drop into the acidic level will cause joint degeneration. So by alkalinizing the blood, you can help reduce joint degeneration. There's also supplements that you can take that can allow the body to rebuild cartilage. Most famous one, of course, is glucosamine. It can help the body rebuild cartilage. And this has been proven in numerous scientific studies that you can take glucosamine orally. You can take it into your mouth. It'll go into your digestive system, and it will go into your cartilage to help your cartilage rebuild itself. Remember, cartilage serves an important role in joint function. Cartilage has got a jelly-like nature that allows lubrication of the ends of the joints and acts as a shock absorber as well. Glucosamine, by the way, can help support collagen in the blood vessels as well. So you can help support the blood vessels that feed the heart and the blood vessels throughout the body by taking glucosamine supplements. Glucosamine supplements can also improve collagen production in the skin, so you can help minimize wrinkles with glucosamine supplements. Glucosamine sulfate can also be used to help rebuild cartilage. The glucosamine supplements have a multiple range of benefits for improving health.
Containing 100% beef gelatin, glucosamine sulfate, chondroitin sulfate, and manganese, the building blocks for bone matrix, cartilage, ligaments, tendons, and connective tissue, American Longevity's Ultimate Glucogel is the ultimate source for healthy joints. And at $17.50 a bottle wholesale, you'll be building up your joints without tearing down your finances. Give your joints the support they need with American Longevity's Ultimate Glucogel.
To order or to pick up American Longevity products, call Scott or Jose at KSCO Radio, 831-475-1080. That's 831-475-1080.
If I keep on the fairway, I might make par.
If I keep from slicing, I might stay out of the sand trap.
If I keep sneezing, I'll never make it through 18 holes. Ugh.
Seasonal allergies can make you feel miserable. Only once daily Allegra 180 milligram tablets have fexofenadine for long-lasting non-drowsy allergy relief, so you can feel more like yourself again. Side effects are low and may include headache, upper respiratory tract infection, and back pain. Call your doctor today about a prescription for once daily Allegra for patients 12 and older. For more information, see our ad in Health Magazine. Call 1-800-ALLEGRA or log on to Allegra.com.
Yeah! Hey, sorry guys, I'm just hot today.
Allegra. Enjoy your world.
We're back. This is KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville, the Saturday special. Charlie Friedman joined by Bert Brandenburg from Justice at Stake. And Bert, I have good news.
What's that?
We have our first caller of the day, and I know this fellow. This is Bob Listener from Soquel, and he happens to be one of the brightest folks who calls this radio station now and again. Bob, how are you today?
Very good. How are you, Charlie?
I'm fine, thank you. Say hello to Bert.
Hello, Bert.
Good morning, Bob.
What prompts your participation today, sir?
Well, from what I heard Bert say, he's right on target. I want to call you. Were probably around at the time, Charlie. Do you remember Prop 14 in 1964?
Yeah, I sure do.
Well, that case involved discrimination.
Maybe we ought to bring Bert up to strength on it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. In 1964, Bert, we had an initiative on the ballot. The California legislature had passed a Fair Housing Act sponsored by Byron Rumford, an assemblyman.
And Jess Unruh.
And, well, Unruh was the speaker at the time, but it was known as the Rumford Act.
Well, there was also the Unruh Act at the time, which prohibited the discrimination in employment, too.
Okay. The voters of California, there was an initiative campaign, and this was put on the ballot as a referendum. We have the initiative referendum and recall out here. To make a long story short, the people of California repealed the Rumford Act.
Oh.
Go ahead, Bob.
They repealed the Rumford Act, which in essence permitted discrimination. So the voters of California, in essence, voted to discriminate against blacks and other minorities.
Mm-hmm.
This appeared before the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. Then went up to the federal, to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court did the same thing. So in this particular case, it really pinpoints the role of the courts. the courts, and if you read Federalist 78, Federalist number 78, written by Alexander Hamilton, said in essence that the courts have neither the power of the person or the sword. They just have the power to rule on legislation.
Bob, you know,
the courts, and they have no power at all. So your example, Charlie, of the Kansas tax law, the judge could do as he say what he liked, or inform him, make any kind of decision he wanted, but it would take the executive branch to carry out the laws.
That's exactly right. And also, as you just pointed out, the legislature, or rather the judiciary, does not have the power of the purse. But I'm glad you raised Prop 14 and civil rights law in general. You give me an opportunity to express myself on that briefly. I see the civil rights legislation and the civil rights decisions as an example of where the court actually helped, was instrumental in bringing our country up to what the Constitution had said. I find backing for example, the Roe v. Board of Board of Education, Brown versus Board of Education, and for the overruling of Prop 14 in the 14th and 15th Amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment, which promises due process and equal protection under the law to all people, regardless of race or previous condition of servitude.
That's right.
Now, so far as I'm concerned, that means that when the Supreme Court ruled that segregated public schooling was unconstitutional, they were on extremely solid ground. And when they ruled that housing opportunity had to be extended to all people, they were on solid ground. These are decisions where I believe that what the court was doing was what Martin Luther King was trying to do. He was holding up the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence with its language about all men created equal and saying to the people of America, here are your promises, live up to them.
Back in those days, though, Martin Luther King was no hero to a number of people.
Well, let's hear what...
They used the states' rights arguments against Martin Luther King, particularly in the South.
Well, under the 14th Amendment, there was no states' right to discriminate. Let's get Bert in on this. Bert, what do you think about this? Actually, Bob and I seem to be agreeing.
I'll agree some as well and take it a little bit farther. The California history is very interesting to me, and it reminds me that an analogy I sometimes use, which is the courts are called upon to be democracy's referees. And that means not only are they there to, you know, be fair and impartial amid whirlwinds, but they know they're going to get yelled at afterwards by at least one side, and sometimes both, and sometimes a really loud crowd around them. And their job is to stand their ground. It doesn't mean they're always right, just like referees aren't always right, but it does mean that they have a job to do and that they're, you know, we try to set up the institution so that they're equipped to do it the right way as often as they can. Well, that's why, for example, we insulate the courts from the type of quick accountability that legislators go through. We, you know, we don't elect judges all the time. Federal judges are not even elected at
right,
all.
Right.
And we make them accountable in different ways for very good reasons, because judges actually have a different job than legislators. Legislators actually have a job of making promises and keeping them. The judge's job is to wait for the case to come and then decide the case one at a time based on the facts and the law and not political promises.
Now, that's a very good good point you've just made, and it brings to mind something you said a few minutes ago about the idea that some legislators have gone on the bench and or people on the bench have behaved as legislators. My favorite example is California's own Earl Warren, who was an attorney general here, a prosecutor, a three-term governor, the only one the state's ever had, a very popular and successful and competent administrator and executive.
And vice presidential candidate, Dewey.
Under Dewey, that's right. And
1944.
But when Warren went to the Supreme Court, he took this executive drive with him. Now, the first thing he did was push through Brown Board of Education, and as I've already said, I see that as a reasonable thing, but a lot of the other things that the Warren Court did were egregious violations of constitutional authority. Let me give you an example. One of the decisions that he and the other justices were very proud of was the so-called one-man, one-vote decision handed down in the early 60s, which mandated that all houses of all state legislatures had to be apportioned strictly on a basis of population.
Baker versus Carr.
Now, if that decision, first of all, the Constitution does not give the federal government the right to tell states how to develop their legislatures. If the court had ordered the states to cut up their federal House of Representative districts on a one-man, one-vote scale, That, in my opinion, would pass muster because that is a federal issue and the Constitution clearly states that the House of Representatives to be made up of districts nearly equal in population. And at that time, I know as well as you do the word district, some of them had three times as many people as other districts. It was a ridiculously egregious abuse. For the court to step in and say, for the House of Representatives, the federal House, you have to do this, would have been one thing. To extend it to the state legislatures was atrocious. The states would have probably been put under pressure to at least extend one man, one vote to their assemblies. But in a state like California, to have both houses made up on population completely destroys the purpose of having a bicameral legislature.
Of course, so in the state Senate, you had counties like Ono, Inyo, and Alpine County.
With one senator.
With one senator, and then you had Los Angeles County with one senator.
In the federal legislature, you have Wyoming with two senators and California with two senators. The job of the Senate is to represent the various entities. So there's a perfectly good precedent for that. I noticed the court did not mandate that California should have 12 U.S. senators, which we would if you went under a one-man, one-vote system.
But if you went, again, the whole idea of the courts is to interpret the laws.
Right, but where does the court get off telling the states how to develop their legislatures? I'd like to hear an expert voice on this.
Well, then this decision should have been challenged in some way, at least to rehear the case.
And this is basically my complaint. There is no redress against a court ruling. Bert, what do you think of that particular decision?
Well, I would say a couple things. One, as a general matter, that if the Supreme Court gets a decision, let's just say wrong, although I sort of put that in quotation marks.
That's fair enough.
You know, number one, the court can come in and reverse it itself. It did this last week with its decision on whether 18-year-olds or younger should be executed. It said, we made a decision a number of years ago. We now think that the right decision is X. That's what it did in Brown v. Board of Education.
Exactly. The case of the courts can reverse themselves, yes.
That's right. And people regularly have tried to challenge decisions that have been on the books for a while, including Roe v. Wade, which a conservative court has chosen not to overrule at this point. There's always speculation as to whether it might happen if the court changes a little bit more. And I guess I would just say in terms of Baker v. Carr, number one, the court has now had about half a century to overturn it if they thought it was egregiously wrong. And the other thing I would say more broadly is that the issue of what belongs in the federal power and what belongs in the state side has been contentious since day one, obviously, for anybody who follows American history.
Of course.
And what you're describing is very parallel to each of the reactions every time parts of the Bill of Rights were applied to the state, which was not automatic at the time, and even some of the Reconstruction amendments weren't considered automatically applicable to the states. Federal courts came in and said, yes, this one is. They sometimes draw back and say certain things are not. But the type of controversy you describe is actually a pretty traditional one throughout American judicial history.
If I could make some ridiculous comparison, the reason for the courts is to prevent, we're supposed to be a constitutional republic in this particular case, protect the minorities, and this is what the courts are supposed to do. Suppose, for example, this is a ridiculous example, that the legislature or the people of California decided that every third man with red hair was going to be shot at sunrise. The courts would come in and rule this obviously illegal and unconstitutional. And then again, to take it a step further, it would be up to the executive branch to enforce the rules of the courts. How can the courts, again, how can 12 men in their black robes come, or 9 men in their black robes come out here and enforce anything? It takes the executive department to enforce the rules of the courts.
Well, to my knowledge, the last time a president actually told the U.S. Supreme Court to sit on it and rotate was Andrew Jackson. And that was, in that particular case, Jackson was indulging in an egregious abuse of the Cherokee Indians, who had taken their case all the way up through the court system, gotten a ruling in their favor, and Jackson said, well, they've made their ruling, now let them enforce it, and promptly forced the Cherokee people on the Trail of Tears. So,
you know, when you think about what I think is the most important constitutional crisis of the last maybe 40 years, interestingly enough, was in the middle of the Watergate, saga. You have this decision by the Supreme Court. You've got to hand over those tapes, President Nixon.
President Nixon
obviously did not want to, felt that it was illegitimate. And to his credit, in the middle of all these problems, he said, I have to obey the court. And in a way, that was the happy ending reverse of what President Jackson did.
What do both of you think about the decisions about prayer in the schools and religious decisions, like Zorach versus Clausen and Pennsylvania versus Shemp? Are you familiar with those, Mr. Brandenburg?
I have to say, I'm not a constitutional expert by training, so
well,
I have no doubt you know more than me.
Well, no, I doubt that very much. But what about the decision involving Pennsylvania versus Shemp, where they outlawed prayer in the prayer in the schools? What do both of you think about that?
I mean, I'll start here, and I'll say my opinion is a bit more personal. Our organization doesn't weigh in on those decisions, and I'm. As someone who very much wants to make sure that everybody has religious freedoms,
sure.
I personally don't mind if we draw a little bit of a line around the schoolhouse where everybody comes together, and where increasingly schoolhouses are very mixed. And I was just at lunch today. I mean, I'm Presbyterian, but I was lunch yesterday, I'm sorry, with some friends of mine who are Jewish, and they were telling me about experiences back in the 50s where they would sit and the Christian prayer got, you know, said, and that was a prayer in school. It certainly seemed innocuous to those who were within that faith, but it was, you know, it was both excluding, and in my mind, from a religious standpoint, I didn't find it incredibly necessary that there has to be prayer in schools when we have prayer in churches and prayer in homes and prayer at other types of events. So, Charlie, you may feel differently. I'd be curious what you think.
Well, I've never been of the opinion that that prayer starting in the schoolhouse was that necessary. I never heard a prayer said in a schoolroom when I was a boy, and that was before that particular court ruling was made. I am concerned, though, that the courts have gone much farther than that in seeming to say, well, any religious expression is prohibited. And that is not what the Constitution says. The First Amendment says that the right of religious expression shall not be abridged by any law. Now, for example, a few years ago, there was a cross up on Mount Davidson in San Francisco that was there for years, and they made him take it down. I can't see why. As a person, you know, I'm a Jew myself. I don't mind a cross up on Mount Davidson. It doesn't intimidate or bother me.
Is Mount Davidson a public property? I'm
just curious. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So that's where the grounds came from. And, one of the things that we see in politics today is the rise of what people choose to call a Christian right. That is a fundamentally reactionary movement. When I say that, I mean it's a reaction to a perceived attack. Just because one person is upset that, for example, you go to a college graduation and there's an invocation. Somebody says, I don't want to hear that. Well, in that case, why don't you just sit down, shut up, and think of something else for a few minutes and let everybody else enjoy themselves. You're not being harmed. If your atheism is so tender that being exposed to somebody saying a prayer is going to somehow pollute you, then you must not be very convinced, is all I have to say. And I say that as a person who, up until a few years ago, was not a believer myself. I'm a recent convert to any kind of religious belief. But I never had the idea that just because I didn't care for it that other people weren't entitled to have their say.
I guess the only thing I would add is that I actually kind of agree with you on the issue of harm. I'm not sure I'm too worried about actual harm coming to somebody if they hear something that's simply outside their tradition or they don't agree with. I think when you look back at why a couple hundred years ago in a much more conservative world, the framers of our country went ahead and said, we're going to draw real strict lines here and do things that no other government has done before, because, of course, they came from Europe where the establishment of religion was very thorough.
Well,
and kings, you know, went on the crown, and that was exactly why they did it. And they knew in many ways they were drawing lines more arbitrarily than they had to, but it was, they believed in terms of establishment of religion. I'm not sure so much the issue of harm if you hear it. But they said, we're going to draw a bright line.
Bert, we're going to take a quick break here. I hear here's the music. And, Bob, I want to thank you very much for calling in today.
I want to thank you for letting me speak. This is a great program.
Well, you stick with it. We've got a couple more callers on the line who are going to be joining us after this brief break. If you'd like to have your little piece of today's conversation, you're certainly welcome at 479-1080. Bert Brandenburg of Justice at Stake will be with us until the top of the hour. And for the second hour of the program, local attorney Tim Clary will be joining us.
I know, Tim. That's a good choice.
Thank you very kindly, sir. So we'll be back with you in just a couple of moments. I'm Charlie Friedman, and you stick with us, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
It's the best snow ever. But before you run up to the mountain, Run by Play It Again Sports for winter clearance prices on everything you need to stay warm and have fun, including one of the best selections of new and used snowboards and clothing you'll find anywhere. Save your money for the mountain with Play It Again's winter clearance prices. And hey, don't forget Play It Again's new and used fitness equipment. Over 100 to choose from. Play it safe. Play it smart. Play It Again Sports on Soquel Avenue in downtown Soquel.
Here's my morning routine. Alarm goes off, hit snooze at least once, force self out of bed, put coffee on, go outside, get the Sentinel, shower, dress, drink my coffee, and let the Sentinel tell me some stories about the world around me. I usually don't think about it a lot because it's just part of my daily routine, but with the way the world is today, I'm glad to have a touchstone like the Santa Cruz Sentinel. The happy and the heart-wrenching, the justice and the injustice, it's all in there. Stories, not just the news, but the stories that help me make sense of what's going on in the world, and most importantly, right here in Santa Cruz County. News is news, but a story can touch your life, and the Sentinel always seems to find an angle that brings the story home. The Santa Cruz Sentinel, your news, your stories, every day.
For what to see and not to see, check out the Santa Cruz Style Entertainment Guide every Thursday and movie reviews every Friday in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, your news, your stories, and your entertainment guide.
Hi, this is Don Fredrickson from GotNet. GotNet specializes in business services. Whether you need a T1 or T3 or just a place to host your website, GotNet has a solution to fit your needs. GotNet offers server colocation and custom website development. We have e-commerce servers, streaming audio and video servers, and cold fusion and database servers available to handle your hosting needs. GotNet understands that businesses rely on the Internet, and we work hard to assure fast, reliable service. Call GotNet today at 460-2000. Food, shelter, clothing, net. Got net?
Selling for 58,812 at 240 months, 6.49 APR, 745 per thousand borrowed, number B24, 763 with tax credit, $5,000 down plus tax license and dock fee.
Come to Scotts Valley, it's the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RV's a merit.
The dollar is up at RVs of Merritt, which means you'll pay only $3.99 per month for a brand new 24-foot 2005 Winnebago that sleeps five. That's right, $3.99 per month for a 2005 Winnebago with generator, microwave, and two air conditioners. Getting there is most of the fun in a new Winnebago from RVs of Merritt in Scotts Valley.
Come to Scotts Valley, the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RVs of Merritt. RVs of Merritt.
And once again, we are back on today's Saturday special. I'm Charlie Friedman. We're talking about the role of courts in society. Ought there to be some checks and balances on them? I'm joined by Bert Brandenburg, calling us all the way from the East Coast. He's with a group called Justice at Stake. He's the executive director, and this group is one that pays special attention to these issues. A couple of things I'd make, just before we broke, Bert, you were talking about what the Founding Fathers had in mind vis-a-vis government and religion. Of course, the example they had to look at was England, where you have an official state church, the Church of England, and if you don't belong to that particular church, there were consequences. You didn't have the same rights and prerogatives other people do. In all fairness, I have never heard anybody, no matter how wild-eyed they were, suggest that there be a Church of the United States of America, and if such a person came along, I would nominate him for the booby hat. So far as that's concerned, that there's you know, no way. It's just not even an issue.
Right. My point was historical, that the radicalism of what the Founding Fathers did to separate government from the church at all.
Well, it was the first.
Was as radical as some people today think is not having prayer in school.
Well, the idea being that ours was the first country to come along and say, worship whatever God you want to worship in your own way, and if you don't want to worship, you can do that too. It is not the government's business. So, now, the one other thing I wanted to mention, we talked a little bit about, you mentioned the one time that Andrew Jackson overruled the court, basically just ignored a ruling. I guess right now that's about the only way that the Supreme Court or one of the courts can be checked against, is if an executive is confronted with a ruling and simply says, well, I don't care to go along with this, which, you know, is kind of extra legal.
There is, of course, the process of amending the Constitution.
Which is...
If you believe that the Constitution has been wrongly interpreted or needs to be changed. And in addition, courts a lot of the time don't necessarily interpret constitutional questions. Sometimes they're simply called upon to interpret a statute that seems unclear.
Okay.
You know, what did that word mean? And sometimes what happens is if Congress doesn't like the decision, they'll say, well, actually, we meant X. You said it was Y. We meant X. Let's go ahead and change it to X. So I'm not sure it's true that there are no mechanisms other than an executive being recalcitrant.
I was going to suggest that possibly, as the legislature can overrule a president, override a veto by a two-thirds vote of both houses, perhaps maybe an overruling of a particular court decision could be made by an legislative two-thirds vote. Let's just throw that out there as a suggestion. We have some callers here, so let's get some more people on the air with us. We want to say hello to Phil in Monterey. How you doing today, Phil?
Yeah, I was wondering if your guest could comment on the 187 proposition that passed, which the court struck down.
Are you familiar with that, Bert?
I think I've heard the number, but maybe you can fill me in.
Proposition 187 was an initiative that was got up a few years ago here in California to the effect that the government was not obligated to pay benefits or provide services to people who were in the state illegally. It became a racial issue. It shouldn't have been. There are plenty of people in California who are Asian, European, etc., who are here illegally. It's not just Hispanics. But the law was passed by an overwhelming margin. It was like two-thirds of the people voted for it, and the courts came along and struck it down. Is that the one you're talking about, Phil?
Yeah.
Well, in terms of any comment, my general recollection, and I don't have the wording in front of me, is that the Constitution does refer to non-citizens in ways that have established certain rights for them over the years, even though they're not citizens. They don't necessarily have all of the rights that a citizen has. But on the other hand, the way the Constitution was written did not at the same time say that non-citizens have no rights whatsoever, which has kind of left it to the courts to say, let's look at this legislation, let's look at that legislation.
In all fairness, Prop 187 didn't say that either. All it said was that there was no privilege on, among illegal residents to receive government benefits. There was no proscription put upon them, no prosecution, no penalty, nothing of this sort.
Right, but it sounds to me like we had an equal protection issue, just as, for example, if you said, let's have benefits only for blacks and not whites, or only for whites and not blacks.
That would be ridiculous.
You would say that's equal protection.
Outlandish.
Right, and that would be an equal protection issue. It sounds to me this might have been an equal protection issue as well, that they looked at the Constitution and said, you can't do that type of discrimination. You're allowed to do certain types of discrimination, but not that type.
There's a similar case going on in Arizona right now. Phil, I don't know if you know about that or not, but in the last election, the state of Arizona passed by a large vote Proposition 200, which is extremely similar to the Prop 187 that we passed here in California. So the courts in another state are now having an opportunity to step back up to the plate on this one. Were you familiar with that? Phil, still there?
Oh, yeah. That made it illegal for the bureaucrats to give services to the illegal aliens.
It's basically the same thing, only in a different state. So now we'll see what the judicial process does with it this time.
All right, have a nice day.
Thanks for your call. We appreciate hearing from you, Phil. Let's move on to our next caller, shall we? We have Billy joining us from Capitola, and we want to thank you, sir, for being with us today.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Good morning.
You're obviously not keeping up with your history. You need to spend more time with Bob Listener, who's a great American. And let's look at some history or even some current events. You know, there is a church in this country. There is absolutely a church in this country, and it absolutely has a stranglehold on it, and people like me are being discriminated against.
In what way, sir?
Well, did you know, and this is a serious question, did you know that in many states of the Union, it is illegal for an atheist to hold office, to run for office? You didn't know that, did you?
No, and I've never heard of any such law being enforced. We actually had an atheist as governor of California a number of years ago, and nobody said a word about it.
Let's not discuss enforcement for the moment. Let's discuss what gets on the books.
There are laws on the books in some states that are obsolete, antique.
How did they get there in the first place?
They were put there at a time when consciousness had not yet evolved to where they would not exist.
I couldn't agree with you more on the last statement you just made.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So, let's acknowledge that, in fact, there is a Church of America.
No.
It's the Christian Church.
No.
The believer. Well, wait
no.
a minute.
No.
Let me have my say.
Okay,
then,
I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead.
For example, I grew up, as a previous caller mentioned, having to say the Lord's Prayer every day in school. What an obnoxious thing that was to me. I hated it. And perhaps it was what they meant to do, or perhaps it was an unintended consequence. But as a result, I've become antagonistic towards Christianity for being so very pushy.
Let me ask you something. If the class was saying this, what if you simply sat there quietly and didn't say it while everybody else was saying it?
I was being thrown out the window by the teacher.
That's over the edge, so far as I'm concerned.
So let's be honest for a minute. There is a, for example, my anti-Christianity went away for a while because it wasn't an issue. I wasn't in school, wasn't being forced to say the obnoxious Lord's Prayer. And so it went away for a while. But then the Christians decided to lie to each other about how they were being discriminated against in this country. A guy like Pat Buchanan gets up at a convention and warns us that there's going to be a cultural war. And I took him at his word. I knew he was right at the time. And I began fighting back. And the fact is that we've lost the war so far. When the red states won this election, when people whose big interest was in keeping other people from having rights. So here we are, a country that's all about rights. We're going to Iraq to give them democracy. But the Christians want the right to keep the homos from having rights.
You know what, Billy?
The Christians want the right to be able to bully the homosexuals.
Billy, you know what I'd like?
What's that?
I'd really like, as you are the mirror reflection of Pat Buchanan. Hang on a second. I was so glad when I'm a Republican myself. I was delighted. I actually broke open a bottle when Pat Buchanan left my party. I was happy to see the last of him. And, he's a very intolerant, narrow-minded person. And by your own admission, you're anti-Christian.
Exactly.
Maybe you see that as a reaction, but I would say that your objectivity is open to serious question.
Bert, of course it is.
Bert, let's get you in on this.
You're right. Of course my objectivity is open.
Hang on a split second.
Okay.
Let's hear a comment from our guest.
Well, I think it sort of shows why we need good neutral courts.
Exactly.
That's right.
And on
any side, I actually, even though I talk about attacks on the courts and I'm concerned about them, I'm concerned about political attacks to take away jurisdiction and to impeach judges and to kind of impugn them unfairly for their work. I'm not concerned when somebody gets angry about a decision one way or the other, because to me that's a sign that they care. And I actually kind of like it. Too many people just don't care and tune out. The angry people at least are tuned in. They care. There are lines you shouldn't cross, but it shows that we do need people on the bench who are willing, even if a majority is against them, to do whatever they think the right thing
is. That's exactly the point. That's why the courts are important. Because now let's look at the other choice, the legislators. Let's take a look at Senator John McCain, a great American hero, right? Isn't he a great American hero?
I would think so.
I would think so, too. Or let me actually say it more correctly. He was a great American hero. When he was a young man.
What is he now, a schlemiel?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm going to say. It was easier to be a hero in the Vietnam War than it is in Congress. He has become a nothing in Congress. Here's an example of that. I heard him say the other day when the big appropriation bill came out.
Yum.
And they didn't allow anyone to talk about it. $5,500 billion, and nobody got to talk about it. And John McCain stood on the floor of the Senate and he said, I know we should talk about this. This should be discussed, but I'm not man enough to tell people they don't get to go on vacation when they want.
Okay,
that's exactly right.
Billy, in all fairness, what you're getting off on here is another issue entirely.
No. It's the legislators can't be trusted to make law is the point. That's why you need the courts. In other words, America thinks, a Christian America especially thinks, for example, because they're the majority, they get to rule. The courts are there to keep sure that, to keep the majority from ruling unnecessarily over the rest of us, from taking away the little rights that we've managed to get.
Well, Billy, I'm sorry that you're so motivated by such an extreme viewpoint. On the other hand, I'll tell you what, I do have another caller on the line I want to get with. I want to thank you for calling in and sharing your views. And you keep listening. Maybe we'll have somebody else who takes your viewpoint.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
I'm asked, and this is something I have neglected to do, to mention that I'm filling in for Michael Swerling today. MZ normally is the gentleman who handles the Saturday special. I'm Charlie Friedman. I am his substitute for the day. And that's why I am here with Bert, and we're talking about the courts today. One other announcement I wanted to make, and this is in the public interest. Girl Scout Troop 1019 of East Santa Cruz and Live Oak have opened up a cookie booth. It's right here at our radio station down here on Porter Drive. Come down, drive through. You can drive in one end of the parking lot and out the other and buy Girl Scout cookies today. They're open from 9 until 12 noon, so there's still another hour left for you to come down and get Girl Scout cookies here at KSCO. Now, having done that, let's get back to our program. We have one more caller on the line. I want to say hello to Gary in Live Oak. Thank you, sir, for joining us today.
Yeah, good morning. I heard listener a little bit earlier, and certainly,
Bob is so well informed and so objective, and you know he has his views, but he's always able to see both sides of a question.
Well, I don't think so, and I think he sounds moderate because he's been out there, you know, smoothed by the the forces and being able to work with a class for years and years, and being a public individual, he certainly. I like him because he puts his feet behind his thoughts and engages and certainly report together on a couple of items.
Move to your point, Gary. We're getting towards the top of the hour.
Oh, okay. Anyway, he was inferring that Californians were racist because they repealed the Rumford Act. The Rumford Act was an administrative law that was its own legislation, its own hearing, its own punishment situation. During those years, we voted a person to the Board of Education statewide who was black. Mayor Bradley was black out of Southern California. We had Willie Brown up here. So I think for him to pull a racist situation on the people of California is wrong. The same way they're doing the pulling the stuff about the Mexican border. And constitutional amendments in the state of California are that. They're, they're literally constitutional amendments. That's what these initiatives are. And I think it's absolutely incredible that the people are getting beaten down every time by these political appointees. I think we have a real problem in the fact that three of the Supreme Court members are now members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Gary,
I don't know if you want to carry me over the hour.
Gary, hang over us, but I can't because we're going
to
have a different case. Hang on, real quick, one of the points you raised that I'd like Bert to comment on. In the case of Prop 14, a person who was interested in racial motives could have voted to get rid of the Rumford Act, but there was also a legal problem with the act. And Bert, take us up the top of the hour, but a little discussion on that. In some of these civil rights acts, some of the anti-people actually had some legal framework to try to hang their hats on.
Well, the job of the courts is to look, only at the legal issues, unless the racial issues actually are constitutional issues. And I can tell you that regularly, people on both sides of civil rights debates are disappointed when courts decide case after case, frankly, the majority of cases on what are viewed as narrow legal matters, like the ones your caller is referring to, because that is their job. And I guess I would just sort of add, because I think I'm going to finish up here at the end of the hour, that the vast majority of the work of the courts is on these less controversial decisions, and they are day in and day out working to interpret the law. And in addition, the vast majority of decisions come from lower courts, and most decisions that people say or outrageous or object to actually get, straightened out or changed by the time they move up the ranks. So, for example, in California a few months ago, you had a death penalty, a guy on death row who said that, injecting me would violate my First Amendment rights because it would prevent me from speaking, which sounds pretty bizarre as legal theories go, and the district court threw it out. And that happens with the vast majority of cases. There is a bit of an industry sometimes to say the courts are, because I agree with them on some cases I can pick out, they're out of control when, in fact, 99% of their work is good, solid lawyering. They get the hard cases. They're paid to make the hard decisions, and they know a lot of people are going to disagree with them, but I'm not sure that's the way to judge their overall effort.
Actually, that's a pretty good way to end up the show. Even people like myself who occasionally get absolutely furious with some decision made and feel it's an egregious violation of the court's prerogatives, I have to admit that most of the work they do is solid. So let's end our program on that note of agreement. I want to thank Gary for calling in and thank all of you who participated. And I hope you stick with us for the last part of the show coming up in a few minutes. Right now, thank you very much to Bert Brandenburg of Justice at Stake. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and thank you for focusing on these issues. It's always gratifying when people in your position take time to talk about courts issues.
Thank you. This is KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. It's 11 o'clock.
USA Radio.
Whether it's fair
KSCO
or...
KSCO 1080 on your dial.
Good morning. It is 5 past 11 a.m. on March 5th, 2005 here, almost noon. And a look at the Central Coast weather. We're looking at areas of morning low clouds, which seem to be just moving out. Otherwise, mostly sunny and warmer. Highs in the 60s, northwest winds, 10 to 20 miles per hour. Strongest in the coast and in the hills. Tonight, we're looking at patchy fog and low clouds near the ocean. Otherwise, mostly clear. Lows 40s to 50s. Lower 50s, northwest evening winds 10 to 20 miles per hour at lower elevations. Northeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour developing overnight in the hills. On the bay, we're looking at a small craft advisory for hazardous seas today through Wednesday. Now I'm going to take you back to the Saturday special second hour where we normally have MZ, but we have filling in for MZ, Charlie Friedman. And here we go.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back. KSCO has the inside track.
Charlie Friedman here today with Tim Clary for the second half of our program, which will commence in a moment.
Sorry, baby, but I really gotta go to KSCO Radio. Bye.
I always love it when they use those old bumpers from way, way back. I can't help but think that somewhere Vern Berlin is smiling down from above, chuckling up his sleeve. I want to thank all of you for joining us on the Saturday special today. This is our second hour. I'm Charlie Friedman. We're talking about the courts and their role in society and whether they go too far now and again. Our guest for the second hour is a local attorney by the name of Tim Clary. Tim, would you do me a favor? Say hi and tell the folks a little about what kind of law you practice.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me, Charlie. I practiced law for the past 15 years. I'm a certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law.
Uh-huh.
But my other passion has always been constitutional law. I was a finalist at my law school in constitutional law moot court exercise, where I got to argue a random drug testing case before some appellate court justices, and I've litigated cases up to the California Supreme Court level on the free speech rights of abortion protesters. So I have a passion for this area that's seemingly unrelated to what I do for an everyday living, but it's something I've followed for a long time.
In this particular case, it makes your expertise and interest far more germane to what we're talking about. Couple of quick things. Number one, we just received a fax here at the radio station. It says, your guest just mentioned the equal protection issue. How do the courts deal with equal protection issues when it comes to criminals? That's essentially the issue with the illegal aliens. Rather than grant illegal aliens rights under the guise of equal protection, they should be sent back home. If a criminal applied for social benefits such as welfare, food stamps, education, etc., and it was realized they were a criminal, they would not be granted these privileges. They would be arrested and prosecuted under the law. I want to thank VVV for sending in that fax. Real quick, like, I want to give our phone numbers and fax numbers here so that you can join us. Tim is here to interact with you on Interactive Radio, KSCO, at 479-1080, 479-1080. We also have a line at 477-1340. And if you want to fax us, as this other gentleman did, you may do so at 475-2967.
Charlie, I'd like to interact with the fax.
Please.
From Vernon.
Absolutely.
In
case you need to refer to it.
No, I don't. He's raising the equal protection issue and the interaction between that and someone as whether or not they're a citizen or an alien.
Uh-huh.
The issue comes up in equal protection analysis because when that is raised as a constitutional issue from the 14th Amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court has developed a series of tests that applies to whether or not something will pass muster as being constitutional or not. It's an analysis called levels of scrutiny, and there are three different levels. There's what's called strict scrutiny, which is the most severe, middle-tier scrutiny, and minimum or rational basis scrutiny. And in the prior decades, the court's decisions have developed areas which, if what's under investigation or judicial investigation falls within one of these categories, it automatically categorizes it for a certain level of scrutiny. And alienage or lack of citizenship is what's called a suspect classification that automatically triggers the highest level of scrutiny. In other words, the government in those kind of cases must show that the challenged classification serves a compelling state interest and that that classification is necessary to serve that interest and does it by the least restrictive means possible. So all those classifications have to be met when alienage is one of the issues.
Thank you very much. And that, by golly, that's what I call a fast turnaround. Want to make one note before we proceed to our first caller, who is already on the line. During the break, I received a call from Mark, who was asking about an eminent domain case. It turns out, Mark, that Tim is familiar with that case. So if you'd like to call in during this hour and discuss that, you're welcome to do so. Just now, we want to say hello to Charles. That's a wonderful name you have there, Charles. Calling from the Santa Cruz Mountains. Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Yes, it is a wonderful name, isn't it?
I love it. You and me and the heir to the throne.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't mind if you made all of the legislative decisions.
Oh, if I were king of the forest.
The term equality has come up here. I've been listening since the beginning of the show today. And now you have someone on, I think, can answer my question. Which
please.
Under the framework of the Constitution, and especially as the Founding Fathers envisioned it, wouldn't issues of equality be given to the states?
Well, that's a good question because, as you framed it, your answer or your assumption would be perfectly correct up until the 14th Amendment, which was added to the Constitution in the wake of the Civil War and Reconstruction. There wasn't any explicit equal protection right until the 14th Amendment was passed. And when it was, that became an issue that the justices had to include in their analysis. So the type of analysis you're suggesting has changed since the Founding Fathers because of the amendment to the Constitution.
Well, then I have to ask myself the question, what was the motivation for the 14th Amendment?
Easy. Historical circumstance. Blacks were not being given their basic rights in states that were formerly part of the South before the Civil War, and Congress wasn't going to let that continue, so they passed the 14th Amendment to make sure that it didn't. There were lots of political motivations.
That's more of what I'm interested in.
The phrase.
Yeah, I'm not interested in what version is given to us by this will get a little deep here. By the federal government by way of establishment media, but what were the real political reasons for this happening? I mean, I know there's always altruistic and there's good intentions.
I'm prepared to respond if you want to let me.
I will do that. I'm sorry.
Okay. This is the time when carpetbaggers arose in our lexicon. Northerners to the southern states wanted to exert control over southern state governments. And they recruited illiterate blacks who'd just been released from slavery to do that. And they were using them and their votes to exercise power over the South. And it was obvious that the South was going to respond to this, and they did it in ways that tried to take away the rights as citizens that the blacks had just been granted. So in response to that, the carpetbaggers made an alliance with the Reconstructionist-oriented Republican Congress and passed the 14th Amendment, and it was ratified by the states in a battle that was brutal. And Charlie's the history professor. I'll let him go on about that.
Well, one of the greatest tragedies that ever occurred was the assassination of Lincoln, because if Lincoln had lived, he had the political skills and the prestige that would have been able to bring about a more conciliatory Reconstruction period, with Charity for All, with Malice Toward None, etc. This was not the opinion of Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, the radical Republican leaders in Congress. Lincoln would have been able to harness these dudes. Andrew Johnson simply did not have either the prestige or the skill, and as a result, he came within one vote of getting his fanny thrown out of office on a bill of impeachment that was absolutely trumped-up nonsense. The Congress passed a law that said the president couldn't even fire members of his own administration, so Johnson fired somebody, and they impeached him for it. Utter nonsense, but he came within one vote of losing his job. Want to thank you for calling and raising that question, though, Charles.
Thank you, Charlie.
Appreciate your time. Have a great day.
Best of everything to you and your guests.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're going to go ahead and take another call right now. We have Liberty on a payphone and Aptos, real quick. Like, how you doing, sir? How are you today?
Actually, I'm kind of under the weather. I got this bug that's going around.
Well, let's hope you get rid of it soon.
Yes, I hope so. Anyway, just a quick comment on the previous call. Being a son of the South, I'm inclined to think that the Civil War actually exacerbated the racial problems that the South had been able to get rid of slavery in their own way, in their own time. It probably wouldn't have created all the animosity that we have today. But
if it had liberty, I'll tell you, if it had, that would have been the best of all possible worlds. But if you read Paul Johnson's History of the United States, he treats this issue at some length. And by that time, by the time the 1850s, 1860s rolled around, the economic forces at work in the South were not working to subvert slavery. They were working to cement it in place. Values of slaves were going up, not down. The South had a firm slave-based economy by that time. And what you wish for here, the gradual fading away of this institution, was simply not going to happen.
I disagree, Charlie.
Yeah, I do too. but
let me give the facts on the other side. All you have to look at is the institution of slavery in South America, where there was no abolition movement. Economically, it did wither on the vine and go away, and that trend was already in place in the southern states. If you want to read a really book-length treatment of this, I would recommend the book called The Real Lincoln by Thomas DiLorenzo. Hmm. In which he contends that what Lincoln was not necessarily the great emancipator, but the great centralizer. His political agenda before being elected was to use the power of government to prop up private businesses. The creation of the monster known as SP that Frank Norris decried in The Octopus, and which brought about initiative and referendums in California, was the direct creation of Lincoln's attempt to create the Transcontinental Railroad through giving away of huge tracts of land on either side of it. I think DiLorenzo makes a really good argument that what was going on was the economic subjugation of the South, and that was behind the Civil War. The firing on Fort Sumter was in the South's response to tariffs that were being imposed without Democratic vote. So, I think good arguments can be made, and it's a fascinating book.
On your side, Tim, the original nullification controversy in South Carolina, which had taken place several years earlier, was over a tariff bill.
That's correct.
And there's no question that was an issue.
And Fort Sumter was the collector of the tariffs. That's the part that's overlooked in the firing on Fort Sumter.
Well, I don't want to get into refighting the Civil War, but. Actually, the firing on Fort Sumter, as far as I'm concerned, was a classic case of maneuvering the other side into firing the first shot.
Oh, yes.
So that you could claim the moral high ground.
Yes.
Well, I think we could all three agree with that.
Yeah.
And, a Lincoln admirer would say that he very skillfully brought that about.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for your call, Liberty.
Well, actually, the main thing I wanted to bring up, I'm sorry, that was actually an aside. I just wanted to make a comment. But there is a clause in the Constitution that has to do...
Okay, well, listen, I've got to interrupt you, Liberty, because we have to take a break right now. It's 20. So what, you want to hang on through the break?
Yeah, I would like to get
okay.
an answer to this question.
Real quick, like, we'll do that. You're in tune with KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. This is the Saturday special, and we have Mark on the line, so we're going to be talking in a little while about eminent domain. Stick around for that. And remember, your piece of KSCO is available to you at 479-1080. Back in a couple of minutes.
$745 per thousand borrowed, number B24, 763 with tax credit, $5,000 down plus tax license and dock fee.
Come to Scotts Valley, it's the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RV's a merit.
The dollar is up at RVs of Merit, which means you'll pay only $3.99 per month for a brand new 24-foot 2005 Winnebago that sleeps five. That's right, $3.99 per month for a 2005 Winnebago with generator, microwave, and two air conditioners. Getting there is most of the fun in a new Winnebago from RVs of Merit in Scotts Valley.
Come to Scotts Valley, the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RVs of Merit. RVs of Merit.
Buying a home around here is an expensive proposition. Hi, I'm Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland. I've been helping people save money on home loans for nearly 20 years, and I'd like to help you save money on your next home purchase. Right now, Pacific Inland has special programs that are helping people save real money when they buy a home. Call Pacific Inland at 831-475-2600, and we'll tailor one of these programs to help you buy a home. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
It's the best snow ever, but before you run up to the mountain, run by Play It Again Sports for winter clearance prices on everything you need to stay warm and have fun, including one of the best selections of new and used snowboards and clothing you'll find anywhere. Save your money for the mountain with Play It Again's winter clearance prices. And hey, don't forget Play It Again's new and used fitness equipment. Over 100 to choose from. Play it safe. Play it smart. Play It Again Sports on Soquel Avenue in downtown Soquel.
And we're back here on KSCO, and just as we left you, Liberty was about to make a point. Why don't you go ahead and do that, and then we'll move on to our next caller.
Yeah, well, actually, it's a question that your guest might be able to answer for me that I'm curious
Excellent.
About. There's a clause in the Constitution that makes a reference to common law, and it has to do, I'm sorry, I'm at a payphone. I don't have my Constitution out in front of me, but it has to do with... in a dispute over a certain amount, which is quite low because it's based on 18th century economics, that a case should be tried under common law. And I know that most law now is statute law, and I hear from time to time about some crazy right-winger going into a court and challenging the jurisdiction of the court based on something as seemingly as frivolous as the gold frames around the flag.
Oh, my heavens. I tell you what, I've got good news. We have a constitution here, and Tim is prowling through my pocket copy at the moment, and we're
looking. I don't need it to answer the question, but I'll let you look at Article 3 where the judiciary.
Okay. Please, go ahead.
Jurisdiction's granted to the courts, specifically the federal courts in the Constitution in Article 3, and it limits, like other things in the federal law, federal government can only act when the Constitution gives it the right to under the limited powers doctrine. And it grants jurisdiction to the federal courts in cases and controversies arising under common law, where there's a diversity of citizenship, where the amount in controversy is now over 75,000, and where it's a direct federal question. But to answer your question about common law, I happen to be teaching right now a course in legal background of business to some college students, and this came up this week as we were covering the constitutional basis for law. And I happened to go on about a 10-minute disquisition on this very issue. What most people don't understand is that common law, especially in English-speaking countries, is the basis for all of our law, including statutes and constitutions. And it arose out of a very specific cultural milieu in which the belief was bedrock in the community that the decisions of a jury of one's peers were capable of discerning both what the justice of the law and whether the facts dictated the verdict. And common law simply is case law. The law is decided in the courts with juries deciding them. And it built up a body of discerning what the principles of justice are in our society. And statutes are merely the codification of common law. And judges' decisions in appellate courts try to discern the application of common law and superimpose the Constitution on top of that to make sure that they all properly line up. So essentially, common law is the basis of all our law, and it still is. But now, in our context, it's not the only basis, because statutes and codes attempt to codify or recapitulate the decisions in common law, and then laying on top of that in our country is a written constitution, to which everything must be the touchstone. I hope that makes sense.
So can a law be challenged if somebody feels that it is contradictory to common law or somehow conflicts with common law?
Well, the assumption there is that there is a conflict between statutes and the Constitution and the common law. And in fact, what statutes do is recapitulate or summarize what the common law is, especially in light of what the Constitution is.
Or it's supposed to.
It's supposed to, and typically in the 98% of the cases it does.
Thanks for the call, Liberty. We appreciate you raising the issue and giving us a chance to get back the foundation of what we're talking about. And we're going to go ahead and move on to our next caller right away. He's been on hold for a while. This is Mark calling from Marina, and I believe you were the gentleman who was interested in the New London case?
Yes.
Mark, you are on the air.
Hey, thanks very much, Charlie, and hello, Tim.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm really interested in how the court will rule, the Supreme Court will rule on Kelo versus New London. Are you familiar with the case?
It's been a while since I saw it flit across my computer screen, so reacquaint me with the facts,
well,
please.
They heard arguments on February 22nd, just last week, but essentially the case has to do with eminent domain.
Right.
And the legality or the constitutionality of public agencies condemning private property and then turning around and selling that private property to other private individuals because they are proposing a quote-unquote higher and better use for the land,
right.
i.e. the generation of more tax dollars.
Right. This case
is those agencies.
This very issue is being litigated in the lower courts here in California. There's a couple of cases in Orange County on precisely this issue. I'll give you the context there. City councils have used their eminent domain power to condemn private land. In one case, the parking lot of a church, so that a Costco can be built next to it to generate higher sales tax revenues for the city. And the issue is whether they have the right to take it in the first place. And if they do, is there a right to compensation? This all goes to the issue of the takings clause in the Fifth Amendment.
Yes.
And there's some settled precedent in the U.S. Supreme Court that have been a result of Coastal Commission litigations, both in the states of South Carolina and California. And the question is whether the court will follow that line of cases or whether it will follow the line of cases that originally began in the court's recognition of municipalities to even zone at all without compensation under the Fifth Amendment takings clause, which is a 1920 case called City of Euclid versus Ambler. And that began the whole scheme of allowing localities to regulate through zoning laws and essentially diminish the rights of property owners to use their property without compensating them at all. I think it's a direct violation of the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment.
I feel the same way, too, and I really feel that if the Supreme Court comes down on what I see as the wrong side of the issue, if they come down in favor of the city of New London, which is proposing to condemn by eminent domain a middle-class neighborhood in order to sell the land to the Pfizer Corporation for a business park, If they come down on the wrong side of the law, no one's property is safe. And quite frankly, it's really going to have a chilling effect on the ability of people to really, I think, believe in the system, because I believe in that your First Amendment rights are truly guaranteed by your right to own property.
Mark, I want to jump in here. This goes to the issue of whether or not the court will stand by its previous decisions. The mm-hmm. fancy Latin name for that is called stare decisis. It's commonly called precedent. And the Supreme Court seems to have chosen to ignore precedent when it wants to, and mm-hmm. to stick by it when it thinks it's in its advantage. I've got a couple of cases that I want to talk about in that regard, specifically the one that arose this week in the capital punishment case of juveniles that raises the exact same issue. And we don't know how they're going to come down to answer your question. Stay tuned for further developments.
Well, you know, there's one case that happened last summer where the Michigan Supreme Court, in a unanimous ruling, reversed itself in this very type of eminent domain case. It had to do with a large neighborhood in Detroit called Pole Town. And in 1981, the Michigan State Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutional for the city of Detroit's redevelopment agency to take this land and turn it into a plant, for sell it to GM, where they built a plant. Now, this last summer, the Michigan State Supreme Court reversed that ruling and said that was an unconstitutional taking. And the Chief Justice of the Michigan State Supreme Court, Robert T. Young Jr., wrote in the majority opinion that he felt that the great flaw with allowing government to declare that by taking private property to turn over to another private operator because it was for the common good was that there is no internal limit as to what government will declare to be the common good. And therefore, there can be no protection for anybody who owns private property from the capricious whim of a government agency declaring that their land happens to need to be taken for the common good.
Couldn't agree more.
Mark, it seems to me that if the Supreme Court pays attention to that ruling, things might go the way you want. I want to thank you for your call.
Hey, thanks very much.
And I appreciate you joining us today. We've got more callers on the line right now, so I want to get right to them. We have had Jim in Monterey on hold for some time. Jim, thank you for calling the program today. How you doing?
I'm fine. I was calling. I'm still going on the on your discussion of the Civil War, and if you read the Confederate Constitution, there is no indication that the South intended to eliminate slavery. And also, from what I've read, they actually planned on an expansionist policy into Mexico and Central America.
Well, I tell you what, real quickly on this, Jim, the major issue that the bone of contention, the Civil War, Lincoln never in the campaign of 1860 advocated abolition of slavery. The Republican platform was against the spread of slavery into the territories. The South was opposed to that. They felt that it wasn't true. They felt that what the Republicans really wanted to do was to abolish slavery. And during the period between Lincoln's election in November of 1860 and his installation in office March 4th, 1861, the process of secession went on under the administration of James Buchanan, making him, in my opinion, the greatest failure the White House has ever seen. He's the only president who can claim that the Union fell apart on his watch. But in all fairness, this is not the issue of today's program. We're talking about court cases and like that. And I guess what I ought to do
I'll just sum up my thoughts then, if that's okay.
Please do.
All these people are upset about the 14th Amendment, or the gentleman Charles, I guess, was upset about the application of the 14th Amendment. But however, I think that he would change his tune if there were no 14th Amendment, and he was not able to receive the benefit of the first 10 amendments of the Constitution anywhere except in federal court.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Appreciate your call. We are KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. You're in tune with the Saturday Special. I'm Charles Friedman, sitting in for MZ today. We're talking about the role of the courts and whether they overstep it occasionally. I do want to mention once again that out in front of the radio station today, the Girl Scouts are selling cookies and will be until noon. If you want to buy Girl Scout cookies, and I certainly hope you do, please drive by and do so. Just now, we have a call from Richard in Watsonville. Richard, thanks for joining us today. Hi, y'all.
I all pretty good.
Just my Kay Kaiser imitation. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know. My take on the Civil War is I think the North was jealous.
Is that what you wanted to call in and talk about today?
Well, no, I wanted to talk about the martial law.
Which one?
Martial law, you know, and eminent domain,
uh-huh.
I would think would go hand in hand. Hand in hand. Every country I ever went to that had martial law had total eminent domain. They ruled, man.
So you're talking about the deprivation of personal liberties being connected with the seizure of property.
What property?
Well, under yeah.
Yeah, under
okay.
That. Under that,
if you take
does your guest know what BARB even stands for?
I'm sorry, Tim. Would you care to respond to that?
Repeat that.
What does BAR mean?
Bar?
Yeah, like the Bar Association.
All it means is that you're licensed to practice law.
It comes from you talk about being before the bar of justice.
BAR stands for something.
Well, it stands for Browning Automatic Rifle, but that's not what we're talking about here.
I'm talking about in legal terms.
Okay, enlighten us.
British adversary rule. Sound familiar?
Okay, that's the bar of justice in British court.
What about when we have martial law versus admiralty law?
Admiralty law is the law of the high seas.
Well, we still have it in the courts on those flags. I mean, I recognize that gold fringe around it.
What's your point?
Well, my point is that I really think that eminent domain is used an awful lot during martial law.
Okay.
I don't disagree with that. Thanks for calling and making the point, Richard. Appreciate it. Have a good day. We're going to move right on to another caller before we take our break here. I believe Jim in Watsonville has been with us for the longest time. Jim, thank you very much for joining us, and how are you doing today?
Reasonably good. My question has to do with the Santa Cruz County and planning departments and some of their statements and their ordinances saying that the planning director, after you sign their permit, says that they can come on to your property and inspect for compliance a year later, and then at any time thereafter. It seems to me that has to do put a big dent in the Fourth Amendment.
No, because as I indicated earlier, under the 1920 Supreme Court decision that granted states and localities the right to zoning laws, those are the laws under which they gain the jurisdiction to inspect your property. And what they're saying on these is merely repeating of what the common law, in other words, the court decisions, as well as statute law already says. They always have had a right to come on your property to see
a search warrant.
To see whether zoning laws are being complied with. They certainly do. No question about that.
Okay.
So if you want to get that reversed, you got to go back and reverse Euclid versus Ambler.
Euclid versus Ambler?
1920 okay. U.S. Supreme Court decision, which I would like to see reversed, but
It seems to me that this is already covered under the California Code, 18-22-50-60, which covers search warrants.
That's covering matters that are criminal. This is a civil matter, and it's under the health and safety provisions of the Constitution, which grants the government's broad powers that the courts have not found to be unconstitutional.
It's immoral. It may not be unconstitutional, but it's downright immoral.
Well, another issue.
That's the way it goes sometimes, Jim.
Yeah, the golden rule. Them has got the gold, make the rule.
Well, again, go back and investigate the 1920 Euclid versus Ambler.
Euclid versus Ambler. Thank you, sir.
It's the city of Euclid. It's a Cleveland suburb.
Right. Thank you very much for your call, Jim. Appreciate it. We've got about, let me see. Why don't we take our last break? about right now, and then we'll get back to the telephones. Pat in Santa Cruz will be joining us next. This is KSCO Santa Cruz. Tim Clary is sitting with me today, and we're talking about legal issues. And one of the other things we're going to talk about after this, we're going to get Tim's views on the recent decision regarding death penalty for people under 18. Back in a couple of minutes on KSCO.
Selling for 58,812 at 240 months, 6.49 APR, 745 per thousand borrowed, number B24, 763 with tax credit, $5,000 down plus tax license and dock fee.
Come to Scotts Valley, it's the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RV's a merit.
The dollar is up at RVs of Merritt, which means you'll pay only $3.99 per month for a brand new 24-foot 2005 Winnebago that sleeps five. That's right, $3.99 per month for a 2005 Winnebago with generator, microwave, and two air conditioners. Getting there is most of the fun in a new Winnebago from RVs of Merritt in Scotts Valley.
Come to Scotts Valley, the door to your adventure. When you enter our friendly RV center, now you can live your dream and share it. RVs of Merritt. RVs of Merritt.
Buying a home around here is an expensive proposition. Hi, I'm Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland. I've been helping people save money on home loans for nearly 20 years, and I'd like to help you save money on your next home purchase. Right now, Pacific Inland has special programs that are helping people save real money when they buy a home. Call Pacific Inland at 831-475-2600, and we'll tailor one of these programs to help you buy a home. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
It's the best snow ever, but before you run up to the mountain, run by Blade Again Sports for winter clearance prices on everything you need to stay warm and have fun, including one of the best selections of new and used snowboards and clothing you'll find anywhere. Save your money for the mountain with Blade Again's winter clearance prices. And hey, don't forget Blade Again's new and used fitness equipment. Over 100 to choose from. Play it safe. Play it smart. Play it again. Sports on Soquel Avenue in downtown Soquel.
The last portion of our program today here on KSCO. This is the Saturday special. Charles Friedman sitting in for MZ on this suddenly beautiful, sunny Saturday morning. I'm sure that we're all going to enjoy the benefit of that. Right now, I want to get our last callers on the line. Let's see. Here's Pat in Santa Cruz. Hi, Pat. How you doing?
Good morning, Charlie.
How you doing today?
I'm all right. Thank you. I've got a comment about prayer in the schools.
Please, sir.
All right. I'm surprised how come this doesn't seem to be brought up when the subject comes up, because it seems like the Bible is very clear on prayer in the schools. Matthew 6, 5 and 6. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the quote when you hear it. It'll take me a few seconds, but just a few seconds if you allow me to quote it.
Go ahead.
And when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret, unquote. Isn't that rather clear?
Yeah, it is.
So
on the other hand,
think about having to make a big show out of praying. You can pray in the school all you want, just don't make a spectacle of yourself.
Well,
isn't that?
That comes back to something I heard years ago. As long as there are examinations given, you will never see prayer leave the schools.
Right.
You like that one?
I was thinking of it at the same moment.
So. I like that. But on a serious note, the point I'm making here is valid, isn't it?
No, I understand that. But bear in mind, the authority you're citing is the Bible. And in the courts, the authority generally looked to is the Constitution. On the other hand, the citation you just made would be a good ecclesiastical reason.
I'd like to put in a plug here for a group called the Alliance for the Separation of School and State, which agrees with your contention and says that the basic problems arise because every interest group tries to hijack the kids for its own purposes.
Yeah.
So
I'd like to say, you know, I think it would be very interesting if the schools, and of course this would be one of those ultimate hot buttons, but I think it'd be real interesting if you could have a discussion of the validity of religion where both sides would be fairly represented so that students could make a rational decision as opposed to simply...
No, it's much worse than that. And this group makes the point that it is immoral to take tax money to support anybody's point of view and force it on somebody else. It isn't a matter that you can contend in the schools and honestly have all sides represented and let the kids make their own choice. It is that it is an abrogation of the rights of parents to have their kids subjected to anybody's propagandizing, whether they be Satanists, Santerists, or Christians. It doesn't matter.
On the other hand, we're exposed, I mean, one person's simple plain fact is another person's propagandizing.
When you get to that point, that's where you have to just say, let's leave it alone.
I'd urge all listeners to go to the website www.honested.com to see the arguments.
Well, anyway,
on
thanks.
This issue.
Yeah. Good show.
Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Pat. We appreciate it. You know, it is you are callers who make KSCO, who make this program and this radio station what it is. We can, you know, sit here and pontificate in front of the microphones, and it gets boring as hell if we don't have the participation of you out in our radio audience. So I want to just take a couple of seconds to say thank all of you. You're doing a great job, and our next caller is Gordy in Boulder Creek. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mr. Friedman. I wish there were more clones of you around.
Oh, so do I. I'd like to see myself everywhere. The trouble is the women wouldn't be able to stand it. I'm so damn handsome.
You couldn't handle it.
At my age, you're right.
I got a letter here from Anna Eshoo, who is our 14th district representative.
What does Lebanon's gift to America have to say?
Well, she was thanking me for contacting her about H.R. 3799, the Constitution Restoration Act. There's some disturbing things in here, at least they're disturbing to me. She first claims it's an infringement of Congress on the power of the judiciary to enforce the Constitution. Now, as I understand, the executive branch is the one that does that, not the judiciary. But right up front here, I think she's confused about articles of religion and establishment of religion. I think there's a lot of confusion throughout the country. Article 1 says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Right.
Yeah. Now, in her letter, it says that H.R. 3799 amends the Federal Judicial Code to prohibit the U.S. Supreme Court and the Federal District Courts from exercising jurisdiction over any local government or government official acknowledging God as the sovereign source of law, liberty, or government. Now, in the preamble of the Constitution, it says that God is our sovereign source of law. Now, bringing it down to the ordinary person, if there is a symbol that is recognized associated with an established religion, well, you've seen what's happened in L.A. County, you know about Mount Davidson, you know about other areas where there have been articles of religion that have been claimed to be religion. I see a big difference there, and according to Black's Law Dictionary, when it talks about constitutional references to religion, they're talking about churches, groups, and these kind of things. I don't belong to any church or any group, but I do believe in God. I do believe in some symbolism, and I see this as an area there that needs to be cleared up, is what is an establishment of a religion?
You know, Gordy, it sounds to me like you and I come from same parts of the ballpark on this. I'm not a churchgoer. I do believe in God, but, you know, some of the things that governments have done seem to me to be, obtrusive against people's freedoms. Tim has been inspired by your call to consult our Constitution here, and what'd you find?
Well, the bill that the caller was referring to is what's typically called by constitutional scholars a jurisdiction limitation attempt. It arises under Article 3, Section 2 paragraph 3 of the Constitution, which says that in all cases, and it lists a bunch of them, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction, but in all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction as this, with such exceptions as the Congress shall make. In other words, the Constitution gives the Congress the right to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And what this bill is trying to do, as others have tried to do in the past, is to say that Congress may not comment after we pass this law. It's a real dangerous thing to invoke, because you don't know what the consequences of prohibiting the Supreme Court's review of that particular area are. The last time this came up was in the context of a free exercise of religion case. It's the Indian peyote case, where a gentleman was not allowed to receive unemployment rights because he was unable to work because of exercising his rights to take peyote. The Supreme Court said it was all right to not give him the unemployment benefit rights, and Congress thought that that was a unconstitutional restriction of religion. They enacted in response to it the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which the Supreme Court then overruled in a case called Bourne v. City of Bourne, Texas v. Flores, where they revisited the right of the Supreme Court to say what is and is not constitutional under the Marbury v. Madison decision. I was unhappy with the outcome and had some correspondence with a law professor who had testified before Congress on the issue, and he pointed out to me that there wasn't really a good resolution to the problem, because if you take Congress, if you take the Supreme Court out of it, and Congress exercises something that is a clear violation of their constitutional limits, then you've limited the Supreme Court's ability to slap their wrists in that case. I don't like it, because you've got a Supreme Court that's not paying attention to precedent right now, as the juvenile capital punishment case shows. So we've got a different solution we've got to implement. I'd be willing to talk about that.
Yeah, now I have a problem with our current Supreme Court. It doesn't seem to be that they're using the Constitution and what Congress has determined it should be a part of the Constitution as a measuring stick to compare the cases against.
That's correct.
They seem to be taking world influence, popularity, and these sort of intangible aspects of common law, and trying to apply them to statute law.
Well, let me give you the commentary from this week's Supreme Court decision on juvenile capital punishment. This is from Justice Scalia's dissent. He said, "The court says in so many words what our people's laws say about the issue does not, in the last analysis, matter."
Yeah.
The majority opinion says, quote, "In the end, our own judgment will be brought to bear on the question of the acceptability of the death penalty under the Eighth Amendment," close quote. In other words, the five of us in the majority will decide for everyone in the United States what is and is not constitutional on this issue, and we'll impose it on you.
Well,
the only real solution for that is for Congress to be real careful about who it appoints to the Supreme Court. And that's why the battle over judicial nominations is the pitched battle that everybody ought to be watching right now.
Well, I also think since the average term now is something like 32 years on the Supreme Court, that we need to have some kind of term limits on these judges. We also need to have some mechanism to remove them from office other than the long, arduous process of impeachment.
I think rational minds can disagree over that. But
I'd worry about that myself.
But I don't think there's any disagreement over the idea that the appointment process is where the key battles ought to be being fought, where they weren't adequately paid attention to in the past, and now we're reaping the consequences of that.
Well, thank you very much.
Gordy, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate your call this morning. We received a fax, Tim, you and I from Steve over in Watsonville. The takings clause is often evaded by local governments who hire friendly appraisers to lowball property valuations, attempt to compensate at assessed rather than real market values, etc. Is there any effort being made to take eminent domain evaluations away from self-interested parties and have them calculated by impartial authorities?
Well, that's always a fact issue in the courts. It's kind of like whether my appraiser can beat up your appraiser. if all you're relying on is the government, then you've not presented evidence on the other side. If you give the court something on the other side to look at, they'll generally make a rational decision. Not always, but generally.
Okay. Thank you very much for your response to that. And we're going to move right ahead to our next caller, Carmen on Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad you called because you mentioned that we have a conservative court, Supreme Court. You've got to remember that Reagan had some, but the last ones that they, like Reagan pointed them, they turned liberal when they got inside the court. So it's not a conservative court.
It's it's not a conservative court right now, I wouldn't say. On the other hand, Reagan did appoint Scalia, who's pretty much a strict construct, and Bush appointed Thomas, but Bush also appointed empty suitors, so there you go.
I mean, you can't guarantee that you're going to room with Ginsburg, too. They thought she was conservative.
No. They knew exactly what Ginsburg was when she was appointed.
Well, there's what, about three of them on the conservative right now? How many do we have?
That's correct. Three reliable.
Yeah, so there you are. I mean, you don't
know
who you're going to get.
And two others who are sometimes conservative and sometimes not, that being
Kennedy and O'Connor.
Kennedy, that's the one I was thinking of. It's on the liberal side. So
Souter's much worse. He was appointed by Bush 41 and flew under radar. Little Davy Scooter went in there. And,
well, this is what I'm saying. You have no, even if Bush gets who he wants to get in there, have no secure thing that they're going to be conservative.
Well, that's true, but that's why you depend on a president to vet his appointments rather thoroughly and not to make those mistakes.
That's why
there's a lot of mistakes. I heard a friend of mine, a very staunch Democrat, the other day say a very interesting thing. He said that George W. Bush is trying to atone for his father's sins. And when I think of the way he handled the tax issue, when I think of the way he handled Iraq, I can't help but thinking that George W. Bush is atoning for his father's sins and correcting a lot of his mistakes. My favorite phrase is he's replacing a lot of his divots.
Oh, come on. Don't be so partisan.
I don't care for Bush 41. I really don't. I'm fond of referring to the 1988 to 2000 period as the Bush-Clinton years. But I don't think that George W. Bush is going to appoint a David Souter. I think the people he's looking to elevate to the bench are going to be much more conciliatory to constitutional law.
And
well,
the
that's
question
what he
is,
wants, but what he gets, that's something else again. Well, after they get in, they ought to be elected. That's what I think.
Well, the real issue is the fear of Republicans in Congress to back the kind of appointments that the president wants to make.
It's, right.
You know, they're in there for life. And a lot of the older you get, and I'm getting old, I know that I'm losing it, too. And they're there for life, and they're up there in their 80s making decisions. They can't even know how to make toast, you know?
In all fairness, there have been cases of people on the Supreme Court who were just plain senile.
So if you vote them in, give them a certain length of time, like they do the senators, 6 years, give them, I don't know, 20 years, then get rid of them.
I have a real problem with that because there are people who served into their 80s who I really admire.
And who were terrific. John M. Harlan.
Hugo Black is one of my heroes. In his own way, even though he wasn't always the sharpest knife in the drawer on every case, Thurgood Marshall provided a moral presence on the court that was remarkable.
Yeah, well, if age has something to
Byron White.
Court,
Byron White was
so.
Another example, a man with whom I mildly disagreed, but his presence on the court was hard to overestimate, and that was Justice Brennan. So it's a difficult argument to
make.
Well,
I'm aging. I'm 84, so I know that what's happening.
So
okay?
you know where you speak.
I'm living in reality, and you're living in la-la land, that a person 85, even my age, I'm sharp, but I still drive. And I'm with everything, but I can see where I'm not sometimes. And you, when you're on the Supreme Court, you can't just be okay.
Well, thanks.
Part of the time.
Thanks for raising the point, Carmen. We appreciate
okay.
it. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
We've got one other caller on the line. I'm going to go ahead and try to take the call. Stan, you got about a minute. Hit it.
Well, I believe that there is an organized effort to destroy the religious foundations of this country. A recent poll showed that 78% of the people polled believe we ought to be able to display the Ten Commandments. 17% said we shouldn't. 4% couldn't make up their mind. If you destroy the religious foundation of this country, you destroy this country, because the Declaration of Independence talks about the fact that our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness comes from our Creator, and that to preserve these God-given rights, governments are instituted among men. The whole idea of our federal constitution was to limit the power of the federal government with a change of the constitution. Those chains have been taken off of the federal government. They're being forged for the people. We're headed towards a dictatorship in America. Liberty and limited government are synonymous. Tyranny and total government are synonymous. Which direction are we going to under George W. Bush? In the name of fighting terrorism, we're taking away freedom after freedom after freedom. I think everybody should be concerned. I fully support the idea of the ability of Congress to limit the power of the Supreme Court. That's what it says in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Let's let them do it and see what happens. We might have a whole lot better country if we had our school children growing up to realize that they are answerable to somebody, specifically to the God.
Stan, that's it. You're out of time, but you did a pretty succinct job. Tim, there's no time for you to comment, unfortunately. Tim Clary, Charlie Friedman, we've been here with you on the Saturday special. This is KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville.
USA Radio Network News, this is Cynthia King. President Bush used his weekly radio address to the nation Saturday morning to discuss ending terrorism as a means to an end in achieving two states for Israel and the Palestinians.
Only by ending terrorism can we achieve our common goal of two democratic states, Israel.